Welcome to the Forum on 90.5 WCBE, bringing you the conversation shaping Columbus, straight from the not-for-profit Columbus Metropolitan Club. The Forum is where leaders, thinkers, and community voices like yours come together for lunch in downtown Columbus to unpack the issues that matter most to Central Ohio. Want to join us in person? Tickets and details about upcoming forums are available at columbusmetroclub.org. There might be more public resources for mental health than ever before, like awareness months, crisis lines, and wellness apps. But when someone's real life falls apart, many of us still don't know what to say, what to do, or how to show up. What happens when the hardest parts of human experience don't fit neatly into the rituals we know, like births, weddings, funerals, and meal trains? This week, we unpack mental health not only as a medical issue, but as a community issue. Joining us are panelists Sophia Fiffner, President and CEO of the Columbus Metropolitan Club, Dr. John Ackerman, Clinical Manager for the Center for Suicide Prevention and Research at Nationwide Children's Hospital, and retired U.S. Army Colonel Bill Butler, who's also President of the National Veterans Memorial and Museum. Your host is Stacia Nakien, news anchor with WBNS 10 TV. This week's forum discusses mental health. If you or someone you know is in crisis, please call or text 988 for free and confidential support. Let's dive into this week's Columbus Metro Club Forum. There's no casserole for that. Mental health, loneliness, and the courage to show up.
Stacia, welcome back to CMC. We look forward to today's conversation.
Thank you so much, Neil. I'm glad you're here today. I'm glad I'm here today because this is a room of high achievers and high performers, leaders. You have high expectations for yourself. And I feel like this is exactly who this conversation is for. And without raising any hands, I feel like we should give ourselves a moment to think about times where we have struggled with losses that the people around you cannot see. Maybe you're walking with that today. How many of us are struggling with losses we don't want people to see? And how many of us, if we knew what the person next to us was carrying, would want to help? Every single one of us. So that's what this conversation is really about. Recognizing in ourselves the burdens we carry, why we don't want people to see that, and how we can show up for each other. There's no casserole for that. Mental health, loneliness, and the courage to show up. The catalyst for this discussion is the essay by our fearless leader, Sophia Fiffner. You sparked the ultimate community conversation with this because there's something for all of us to walk away with today. You wrote, "I was so good at showing up, nobody knew I was disappearing." And it feels like high-achieving people are really kind of the hardest to identify as struggling. And you are the high achiever. I've always felt that way about you. And your essay details a year that came in waves of loss that, quote, "By the time the year was over, almost nothing of the woman who had started it was still standing." So stripping away all the ways you defined yourself, perhaps grieving those layers because they were part of who you believed you were, you came to an important question: who was I? And if you would take a moment to start the forum by sharing what you have learned in that answer to the question today and how that has taken root.
Well, one, thank you so much for being here in the audience. You know, I, as a CEO of the CMC, I feel very committed to creating an organization and supporting an organization that's an institution where we create spaces for conversation. I'm going to be speaking as myself, so not as a CEO of an organization or an institution, but just as a Black woman who went through a lot. And so for those of you who haven't read my article, within about a six-month time frame, my grandfather passed away. I lost a really important friendship in my life. I was going through a divorce. I came out as a lesbian to my very conservative family. I moved into another space. It was a lot. And every single day while all of this was going on, I stood here at the CMC stage with a smile on, because I didn't want anybody to know that I wasn't fine, that I wasn't strong, that I couldn't handle all the things that were happening in my life. And so to answer your question, like, what did I learn? One, I learned that I am really good at teaching civics. I can teach you every which way to write legislation, how to fundraise, how to lead a civic organization. You want to be more connected in your community? I can tell you what organizations to connect with to do that. But I am really bad, like terrible, at welcoming people in, at receiving help and being vulnerable. And modeling that as a leader when you're in a really visible role, that's something that I'm still learning and still trying to understand, that gap between helping others, but then also receiving help in return.
This is a road you could have traveled personally, by yourself, and that still would have been tremendous, in a tremendous process. You chose to speak very publicly about it. Why was that important to you to share in this way?
So a friend of mine sent me a text this morning, and she quoted Audre Lorde's poem about survival, and at the very end of the poem, it speaks to speaking up, right? And I felt as a leader that I had a choice to make. You know, I felt so alone last year, and I knew, like, multiple people go through divorces. That's not uncommon here in the United States. Multiple people come out. But I kept on thinking about the person who also feels alone, who perhaps grew up in a really conservative small town in rural Ohio, you know, promise rings and purity culture, and is navigating these big life shifts at the age of 20, 30, or 40 like myself. I wanted them to feel a little bit less alone. And for the black women or women of color who work and lead and do amazing things here in Central Ohio, you know, when we have them, I always think about this, when we have guests on our stage or individuals in the audience, I think about all of the weight that every single person is carrying. I wanted to share my story to help them also know that that they weren't alone. And then last, for myself, I just couldn't live, to be honest with you. I couldn't live. I needed to be completely me in every possible way, and it was really hard to continue to mask parts of my identity with my community and feel like I was truly doing the work that I felt was important, which was being a civic leader and a convener of people who feel like they can walk into this room, any room that we create here in Columbus, and feel like they can be truly wholly themselves. So that's why I decided to speak out.
Well, and writing about it is one thing, and face-to-face one-on-one conversations is another thing. Having a forum about it is a totally different thing. Hello to everyone here and online as we speak about this. How do you think being open in this way and taking this journey in this way has impacted the healing process for you? There's a lot of faces out there.
There are a lot of faces out here. Thank you so much for showing up. And for those of you who are tuning in online, you know, one thing that I taught, or that I learned just speaking so honestly and openly, is one, that Columbus, man, on a human to human level, there are so many kind and generous and loving people who live, work, play, exist here in Columbus. And if I learned anything, I really hope that we can create more conversations on how we can show up for every single person who doesn't have the capacity to have a forum about their experience, or who doesn't is not in a place where they can write about their experience and share it with others. I really hope that we can create a bigger conversation for kindness, for neighboring, for belonging, for, you know, showing love, and then also, like, figuring out how do we make sure that people just don't feel alone, like that doesn't even exist in the first place. I hope that that's what we can accomplish today from this conversation and from having a more visible topic or discussion about it.
Colonel Butler, you shared the impact of the collapse of Afghanistan in August of 2021, and there is a quote downstairs featured here in the museum that you'd been holding out hope for a successful U.S. mission, and that hope allowed you to justify the deaths of your friends and brothers in arms. And you write, "When it was apparent that all hope was lost, the raw, palpable emotion of our mission failure, their deaths and the tragedies for their families was almost unbearable. And it all came bubbling up from where I had stuffed it down for years. The nightmares, the guilt, and feelings that I did not do enough, even though I deployed multiple times, consumed me. For you, this was not a geopolitical event. It raised grief, it raised painful questions. And this is definitely grief that does not fit into a socially recognized category, and maybe perhaps especially in Columbus, where we have a lot of veterans here, but we don't have a military installation where people live and work in a traditional sense. This is not something that a lot of us can relate to in that way. Can you take us through the moment that you realized this was affecting you more deeply than perhaps you expected?
Yeah, so I retired from the Army in 2017, and my transition was relatively easy. I became a Department of the Army civilian working at U.S. Army Africa over in Vicenza, Italy, and I'd been assigned there twice when I was on active duty, so I was around a lot of people I'd already served with previously, folks who had also retired and became Department of the Army civilians, so it was, my wife and I kind of joked it was retirement light because I was around people I knew and loved and respected and doing a job that I was very familiar with. And then for a number of reasons, we came here to Columbus for this opportunity. And it revolved around, the catalyst was a former soldier of mine had committed suicide. And so I was at a fellowship at Harvard for senior executives in the federal government. And during the course of the modules, one of them was finding your true north. And for me at the time, it was, what can I do to understand veteran suicide to maybe prevent another one out of the group of 900 guys that I'd been their commander for 3 years in Italy and a year in Afghanistan. And there had been several suicides before Bobby King's, but his was one of those that was inexplicable because he was a great leader. He'd been promoted a couple times. He'd been selected for a very prestigious school in the Army. And then he, you know, he's a great friend, a great leader, great family man, and he suddenly took his life for no reason. There were no signs outwardly on social media. And then, so I was focused on veteran suicide. Veteran Museum popped up, and I thought, okay, perfect. This is my true north. So long story short, came here. And then in August of 2021, you know, those scenes on TV of, you know, just the sea of humanity at Bagram or Kabul International Airport, people attaching themselves to C-17 and taking off outside of the aircraft and then, you know, plummeting to their deaths, women handing their babies over concertina wire barriers to soldiers and Marines. I mean, it was just heartbreaking. So that was part of it. The other part was, you know, steel band on my wrist. I've got the names of six guys I served with, killed in action. Guys I was really close with, friends, comrades, soldiers of mine, paratroopers, Rangers. I know at least six more men that I served with who were also killed, but I wasn't especially close with them, but it's still six more. That's 12 total. I know more men and some women who've taken their lives after they left the military or while they were still on active duty, like Bobby King. So there's a lot of you know, human emotion and relationships tied into service in Iraq and Afghanistan over the course of 20 years. And the third reason was our son at the time was a lieutenant in the Army. His roommate deployed to Afghanistan as part of the withdrawal operation. His battalion was alerted for that. Our son's battalion was the next to go in the event that things got worse and worse. So it was really those three things, the suicides, the soldiers that I served with and respected and lost, and then having to come to grips with the realization that those losses were in vain for a failed cause, and you know, there's no bringing those guys back, and there was no success for my generation of men and women who served our country in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Service members, veterans, law enforcement, I think in our minds as a society, these are people who are the picture of strength. And that's how we view you. There are so many people who depend on you, people who are, as you said, under your command, but also people like us, faces that you don't see every day, but we depend on you in a totally different way, even though we don't necessarily know you specifically and you don't know us as you are doing your job every day. For veterans and others in high responsibility cultures, what messages about strength or self-reliance can make it harder to seek help?
Yeah, so you know, pretty much from day one when you're in the military, you're probably doing the most physically mentally challenging things you've done up until that point in your life at age 18. You know, you're doing ruck marches and, you know, runs and obstacle courses and working as a team and, you know, socializing with, you know, people from across the country who are in your platoon in the training environment. And because you don't want to let your teammates down, the mantras and sayings are, you know, suck it up, drive on, don't quit, those sorts of things. So from day one, you're inculcated with this idea of, you know, not failing your teammates, not showing weakness, those sorts of things. And I think that's just, you know, one of those experiences that if you've been in the military, you have. And then when you're suddenly in a position where you're the one struggling, you know, it's hard to reach out. And, you know, with the folks and friends and teammates that I've seen on social media, posts that are disturbing, and then when you directly reach out to them and say, hey, man, are you doing okay? Is there anything I can do? More often than not, they're appreciative of it, and then they respond, and then they talk about it and whatever the issue is, and you can get them the help and assistance that they need. But part of it is people, everybody being attuned to those tells that somebody may be struggling with something and needing help, and asking for help, but not, hey, I need help, and recognizing that and intervening directly. And saying, my wife, you know, we've been married 33 and a half years, and, you know, during the Afghanistan withdrawal, she said, hey, are you doing okay? And, you know, at that point, it had been a couple of days, and I took a day off work, and I was calling friends I'd served with to make sure that they were doing okay, but it was really more for me, and she recognized that, and I said, no, I'm not, and I needed some help.
That is significant. There's a lot of research on what makes it hard for providers, helpers to seek support. And I want to ask Dr. Ackerman about that. But first, I do have to ask you, when you are the expert on mental health and suicide prevention and research, this is your work. You're the expert. This is what you study. We all turn to you. Who do you turn to?
First of all, expert's a little bit of a heavy term because there's so much we don't know about mental health and what it takes to sort of address these really challenging times. I just first of all wanted to thank both Sophia and Bill for sharing their stories. The research says one of the most effective things you can do to empower people to seek help is actually sharing your stories. When you're someone who's visible, when you're someone who's respected, as each of you are, being able to share that with others is such a powerful gift to the community. So just thank you both so much. You know, I think the things that I do to get support, it is a heavy topic. I support a center that addresses youth suicide. There's many tragic things in the world. A young person taking their life is very tragic. I have a team here front and center that is here today, but also I can go to for support. We have a mantra within our team, the work we do, it's never worry alone. You make sure that you're getting support, you have other team members you can turn to, and you know that you're not alone in carrying this. I have a family that I care deeply about, and we, for better or for worse, I have a wife who's also a psychologist, so I have free in-house support all the time, and we go back and forth a lot. But yeah, and you find things that you care about, that you do, that you value, that energize you. And then I think a benefit of being in the mental health field is that you don't buy into the myths that only weak people get support. You don't buy into the idea that there's something wrong with you if you're struggling with anxiety or depression. You watch people. You've supported young people and families and people who are super successful that navigate distress, that it's a normal human function to go through hard times and to reach out for support, you're much, much more likely to navigate that and to come out on the other side as a person who's like sort of more sort of in tune with what's going on, with doing the things that you need. So I would say the things that I try to talk about when we're talking about people getting support when they're struggling are the things that I try to do. I will say, like everyone on this stage, I do fail at times to like use the tools that we reach out to. We're much better at giving help than receiving help. And so I've tried to practice what I preach more and reach out for support and talk to people when I need it. But there's a lot of research that says healthcare providers and community leaders are, even though they indicate that they need support, about 2/3 of us are indicating a real need for support, only about 1/3 of individuals actually reach out for support. So there's a big imbalance, and fortunately there's something we can do about it.
So what is it? Is it fear? Is it, and maybe where that fear comes from, if you could speak to what the research shows about why we're afraid to share our struggles and ask for help, especially when we know we have people who love us, we have people who care, we have people who are maybe walking in the same journey. Why aren't we asking for help?
So there's a few things that immediately come up when you look at the research in this area. And one is that people who help others, they view it as their role to be the person who is helpful to others. And they also view it as themselves, if they were to need help from others, that they might be a burden, that they might be causing other ones some challenges. They view themselves as the helper, the person who gets things done. And there's also a piece of stigma in the world that we live in, where if we're struggling, maybe we're not maybe we're not as equipped to do this work. Again, I want to be really clear, that's false. It's not true. People who are actually getting help and reaching out are showing and modeling to others that they are worthy of support, that getting help and making sure that they're working with others is a team effort, and that they don't have to navigate it alone. So it's like, it's part of the role. There is very real mental health stigma still in the world, even though we're doing better, even though apparently it's all over TikTok, it's all over social media, it's everywhere. But to do this work well, I think it will take leaders modeling. When I'm starting to struggle, I'm reaching out. I don't actually have to be in a suicidal crisis to reach out for support. If I get support when I'm starting to feel like I can't sleep, like things are thrown off, my day-to-day, I'm really irritable, I'm not waiting until I've reached this sort of point where I need emergency care. And so that's kind of how we think about things in the prevention world. Why wouldn't we get support upstream as things are emerging? It's a lot easier to get that support. You benefit from it a lot more. And then you have a chance to say, yes, I'm part of a community that I'm teaching other people. When I need support, I know where to get it. And that could be through a formal treatment provider, it could be through faith-based care, it could be your neighbor, it could be all sorts of things. But finding out in advance of a crisis who you're gonna go to is really helpful.
Just to add to that, so I think John made an important point, and Sophia, thank you for having the courage to publicly share your struggles and your story, because I think it's important. So when I had taken command of my infantry battalion of paratroopers, 900 guys in Vicenza, Italy, they had just come back from a 15-month deployment to Afghanistan, and it was a really challenging, difficult deployment for that brigade. The brigade of about 3,500 guys had lost 45 killed in action. And about a dozen were killed in the middle of the redeployment from the battalion that I had just taken command of. That one battalion of 900 guys had been awarded 3 Medals of Honor, 3 Distinguished Service Crosses, dozens of Silver Stars. So our nation's highest awards for valor, which just shows the difficulty and the challenges on that particular deployment. And if a unit of 900 men had PTSD, it was that unit. They were getting in fights with each other. They were getting in fights with our sister battalion. They were getting in fights downtown with Italians in Vicenza, Italy. They were just doing all kinds of really disruptive things. And at that point in time, I'd been in the Army for about 18 years. Most of my time was in infantry and special operations battalion. So I thought I had seen it all I was well equipped with how to deal with young soldiers, paratroopers, and rangers, particularly with discipline issues. Nothing resonated. And for months, I was pulling my hair out on, you know, how to deal with these guys and get them focused, because I needed to get them ready for, in 12 months, another deployment to Afghanistan. And nothing was working. Everything I tried, direct interactions with the paratrooper, direct interactions with the paratrooper in his chain of command, group punishment. I tried everything that I had seen. Nothing was working. And then about 6 or 7 months into that period of difficulty, one of the squad leaders, so a staff sergeant that was in our battalion, I had heard through the grapevine that he was going to seek behavioral health counseling for some challenges that he was experiencing from the deployment. And this was a guy who was awarded a Distinguished Service Cross and a Silver Star, probably one of the most highly decorated soldiers coming out of Afghanistan. And so I pulled him in my office with my command sergeant major and said, "Hey, Sergeant Phillips, I heard you're going to mental health counseling." And he was kind of reluctant to answer because there's a stigma on, particularly the military side. If I get mental health counseling, I'm going to lose my security clearance. I'm going to be non-deployable. They're not going to let me go downrange. I'm going to fail my teammates, on and on and on. And so he finally answered. He said, "Yes, sir, I am. My girlfriend gave me an ultimatum. She said it's either go get help or I'm leaving you," sort of thing. So I started seeking the help, and it has been helpful. I said, "Perfect. Can I pull you in front of the battalion, and will you share that story?" Because he was one of those informal leaders, highly respected because of who Eric Phillips was and the things he had done on that previous deployment. And he thought about it for about a second. He said, "Yeah, sure, sir, I can do that." So the next day, we had an impromptu battalion formation, all 900 guys on the parade field. And I pulled Eric up and I said, kind of did the scene setter on the difficulties we're experiencing. And I pulled Eric up and said, "Eric's going to share something with you." And from that day on, it was like a light switch had been turned on and the discipline issues evaporated. Because a leader, an informal leader, highly respected, had the courage to get up, number one, get help, and then number two, be open about sharing it. So, Sophia, thank you for sharing your story.
Now, before today's conversation, we did ask attendees to take a short survey about the ways connection and support show up in your own lives, in our own lives. The strongest response was not, "I feel alone all the time." It was, "It's easier for me to give help than to receive it." And that was followed closely by, "I've got it is my default, even when I'm overwhelmed." And so I would like each of you to speak to what those responses meant to you when Doug shared those results with us. What did you see in those results that resonated with you, maybe for you, from your own journey, and what you took away from that? Sophia?
Yeah, I wasn't surprised by the response because that's exactly what I learned after sharing my story with so many people. I received hundreds of handwritten letters and emails and text messages and DMs. And the common thread that I noticed in a lot of the responses was, one, people would share their own experiences of being a high achiever or a high performer and not really having anyone to turn to. So it wasn't that they were alone, but they just didn't even know how to ask for help. And I thought, I was trying to think, like, why is that? And for me, and I'm sure that this hopefully will resonate with a couple of people, but for me, one, I'm a first generation American. I feel very thankful that my parents came to the United States. They worked really, really hard. I never want to be a burden on them. I want to work really, really hard. I've got it.
You are listening to the Columbus Metropolitan Club's weekly forum on 90.5 WCBE. There might be more public resources for mental health than ever before, including awareness months, crisis lines, and wellness apps. But when someone's real life falls apart, many of us still don't know what to say, what to do, or how to show up. What happens when the hardest parts of human experience don't fit neatly into the rituals we know, like births, weddings, funerals, and meal trains? This week, we're unpacking mental health not only as a medical issue, but as a community issue. This week, we're hearing from Sophia Fiffner with the Columbus Metropolitan Club, Dr. John Ackerman with Nationwide Children's Hospital, and Bill Butler with the National Veterans Memorial and Museum. Your host is Stacia Nockin with WBNS 10 TV. We'll get back to this week's Columbus Metro Club Forum. There's no casserole for that. Mental health, loneliness, and the courage to show up after a short break.
We've been to Mars and back, learned lessons from ancestry, and seen peace forged after generations of conflict. That's just a small sample of the leadership experiences we've uncovered in our interviews with the world's top leaders on innovating leadership, co-creating our future. I'm Maureen Metcalf. In our weekly podcast, we talk with CEOs, researchers, prime ministers, and more as they share their experiences, philosophies, and real-world lessons learned about becoming successful leaders. It's all part of the WCBE podcast experience at wcbe.org and the WCBE app and on NPR One.
I know when you hear podcasts, you may think, I'm not great with technology. I don't want to have one more thing to worry about. But I'm here to tell you, you're missing out on so many amazing stories. And WCBE has made it easier than ever to listen to their own curated list of locally produced podcasts. Just go to WCBE.org and click the podcast experience. You don't have to learn how to use any new technology. Just click on the podcast you want to hear and click play. And don't forget to listen to my show, The Internet Says It's True with Michael Kent.
Hi, this is Sue Foley, inviting you to listen to Music Journeys. Hear local and national artists share how the love of music began and what inspired their latest project. Mike Foley blends it all together with some music. Now, you can't believe him if he says he's related to me and inherited my musical talent, but you can be sure that other Foley will deliver a worthwhile listening experience too.
I guess I'm all right being that other Foley. Listen to Music Journeys Saturday afternoons at 3:30.
And in the podcast experience at wcbe.org.
Welcome back to the Columbus Metropolitan Club's weekly forum on 90.5 WCBE. There might be more public resources for mental health than ever before, including awareness months, crisis lines, and wellness apps. But when someone's real life falls apart, many of us still don't know what to say, what to do, or how to show up. What happens when the hardest parts of human experience don't fit neatly into the rituals we know, like births, weddings, funerals, and meal trains? This week, we're unpacking mental health not only as a medical issue, but as a community issue. Joining us this week are Sophia Fiffner, President and CEO of the Columbus Metropolitan Club, Dr. John Ackerman, Suicide Prevention Clinical Manager with the Center for Suicide Prevention and Research at Nationwide Children's Hospital, and retired U.S. Army Colonel Bill Butler, who's also the President of the National Veterans Memorial and Museum. Your host is Stacia Nakian, news anchor with WBNS 10 TV. This week's forum discusses mental health. If you or someone you know is in crisis, please call or text 988 for free and confidential support. Let's get back to this week's Columbus Metro Club Forum. There's no casserole for that. Mental health, loneliness, and the courage to show up.
Two, as a Black woman in a leadership position, there's no room for mistakes. And I say that in that I've worked both for the federal government, for the city of Columbus, and corporate America, and nonprofit organizations. I can't tell you how much feedback I get directly to me and behind my back about my hair, my jeans that I wear on a CMC stage, to how I'm speaking, to how I'm performing, to how I'm looking. There's no room for error. So for me, what I've learned in the 20 years of working as a professional is I've got it. And then just as a woman, you know, in any leadership position, just, you know, Black woman, as a woman, it is really hard. Like, we've been taught, you know, boss girl mentality, I've got it. There's a whole shop called Boss Girl. And then as I was driving in today, I was thinking, because this is just where my brain goes, I was like, yeah, even the music that I listened to when I was in college, there's that song, what's that song called? Oh, it's from Webby, the independent song where you're spelling it out, I-N-D, right? I don't rap, I can't rap. But you know what song I'm talking about. It's part of your culture where if you are a woman, if you are a Black woman, you are the strong person, I've got it. And to me, I think that those are the loneliest words in the English language, I've got it. I really think that we need to shift from I've got it to we've got you. Like, we need to move from this individualistic, I've got it all the time, I can do it by myself, to actually, we all need each other. We really need to lean into that. And that means not only being caring for others, but receiving care in return.
Colonel Butler, do you have anything to add to that?
Like Sophia, the responses are not surprising at all. You know, there's a saying in the Army, command and leadership is lonely. And it very much is when, you know, you're responsible for everything your unit, your organization does and fails to do. And, you know, when you lose soldiers in combat, there's a number of things that, you know, go through your mind. And, you know, did I plan correctly? Were there things I could have done better? Did I make the right decisions? Should I have made that decision on a different timeline? Did the organization and the soldiers under my charge have all the resources they needed to successfully complete their mission? And if you go down the shoulda, woulda, couldas, which is really easy to go down when you lose men and women in combat, then you know you can just spiral out of control. And those decisions have been made. And yeah, you want to be able to learn from them, but you cannot dwell on them. And same thing in an organization. You know, the leadership is, it can be lonely because you don't have a peer in the organization that you can, you know, kind of open up and share, you know, some challenges, struggles organizationally that you might be thinking about. And, you know, so who do we rely on to do that? And it's got to be peers or spouses or friends who are, you know, separate from the organization. You know, you certainly aren't going to be able to go to a board member and say, oh, you know, I've got all these, you know, challenges, because then that might, you know, show, you know, weakness or indecisiveness or things that they may not want in a leader of the organization that they're on the board. And you're certainly not going to be able to share that with a coworker at, you know, various levels within the organization, because they're expecting you to, you know, lead them and provide the strategy and the vision and help navigate through challenging times. And if you as the leader are struggling with some of those you know, decisions, vision, that sort of thing, then yeah, that's going to be a challenge. I would say we as leaders have got to have the courage to seek the help and ask people for assistance.
Yeah, and I just wanted to tag team what you said, because I remember opening up to a leader locally and I was sharing it like in three sentences. I was like, well, I'm going through a divorce. Came out to my parents, and you know, I had a night where I really just didn't want to wake up. And they were like, you cannot tell anybody. If you share this, like, that's going to be really challenging from a donor standpoint. So, man, I feel for you, but you got to keep that private. That is the culture of leadership that we have here in Columbus, Ohio, that leaders mean that you do not have any human emotions. And that if you do have human emotions, and there are only one type of human emotion, and that's one that can make decisions, never cries, never has like real life human experiences, whether that be miscarriage or divorce, that you are a decisive person and you got everything together. And I just can't, like, I don't know one person who actually lives like that. We all have stuff going on. We all experience things at one point or time or another. And if we don't change that perception, then I just worried. I'm like, man, I didn't want to be a statistic. And not to derail the conversation too much, but I remember I was traveling to New York City with a friend, and in a previous life, I spent a lot of time in pageantry. And there was a woman named Chelsea Christ who was Miss USA, and she was an anchor for, you know, a national television show. She was well known. She was very gregarious and bubbly. And I think if you looked at her photos on Instagram or saw her on television, you go, man, this woman has everything together. She ended up committing suicide. She jumped off of a building. And her death was such a shock to the pageant community, but it was also a wake-up call for me that there are people who are high-performing, who are really bubbly, who look totally fine, who are really dealing with some things. And I was almost in the same place that she was. And so if I didn't speak out, if I didn't do something about it, I just worried that the shift in culture around leadership just wouldn't change. And it needs to change, because there are lives that are dependent on it.
So there's the piece of being willing to share, and then there's also the piece of showing up for each other. And Dr. Ackerman, when someone I care about is struggling, I want to fix it. I want to say the right thing. I want to do the right thing. I want to solve it. But maybe the big takeaway here is also that it's not about solving something, but being willing to sit with them. And I know Sophia spoke to that in her essay as well. What's your advice on how we can be there for each other and best show up for each other?
Yeah, So we work a lot at Nationwide Children's Hospital with younger people, but the same advice applies to colleagues, adults, friends. When it comes to someone being at a point where they don't know if taking the next step, living the next day is worth it to them, the most important thing you can do is be there for them, sit next to them, try to carry some of the weight, not try to solve things. I think it's easy to be like, a lot of us are fixers. What can we do? What can I give you? What can we do? A person is dealing with a really, really heavy thing, and likely they got there not through the last 10 minutes, so they're not going to fix it in the next 10 minutes. Being there and sort of sharing that space with them is really important. Helping them navigate what could be the next steps, helping them know that you're there for them, whether or not you can actually do something immediately, can be really helpful. I think what I heard both from Sophia and Bill too was that there are people who have heavy, heavy responsibilities, but they're told not to share any of that burden. We know one of the biggest risk factors for suicide is carrying a burden that you don't feel like will ever change, that there's no path forward, that you're trapped and you're stuck. The best way to get unstuck is to be there with other people, to share ideas, to share some of that weight. And so I think that's really important. There's actually been a whole bunch of studies, both in the US and internationally, that one of the worst things you can be in terms of your mental health is self-reliant. Self-reliance, especially among men, although it carries across gender too and sex, but it shows that you're 46% more likely to have suicidal thoughts if you're one of these completely self-reliant people who doesn't share with anything. So if our goal is to help people, we sometimes say you can't pour from an empty cup. If we want to be there for other people, we need to insist that we are there for ourselves. It can feel cliche, but if you really want to be there as a community leader, as someone who's helping other people, you need to model that. You need to be there and get that support. We need people to be there. And that's because you have inherent value for who you are. You don't need to earn support. You don't need to be in a place where you've done enough for someone to care about you. Like, we are all here in community. And like you said, when you reach out and you tell your story, you realize how many people truly value you, and they don't need you to earn X amount of dollars and bring in this amount of attention and grow this business in this way or achieve X metrics. You are valuable for who you are. And so being open to receiving that is also a signal to other people that they should be open and available to receive support. So I think that's something we can all do.
It is CMC's longstanding tradition to take audience questions. So we're going to move to those questions from our live stream and in-person audience in just a couple of minutes. So if you have a question for our panelists, we hope you will head over to the microphone where Doug is. And if you're joining us on YouTube, drop your questions in the chat. So before we turn it over to the audience panelists, I do want to ask, who was there for you in that time when you really needed it? Who was there for you, and what would you like to share about what made that presence so special and supportive for you?
For me, I would say, if you read my article, it was not just the divorce, but also the loss of my closest friend. So if you know Dunbar's numbers theory, where you have like your core group of people and then layers of people who know you, I lost that core within a really important time. So to me, it was multiple people who showed up in really meaningful ways. It was, when I came out to my parents, them saying that they still love me, to a nonprofit leader who gave me a hug. She just could tell that there's something going on, and she just gave me a really great hug. It was two friends who helped me figure out what plates I should have in my apartment, because I hadn't shopped for things like that in 15 years. It was those small moments that really made a difference for me and helped me navigate this really challenging time. And then I'm a very religious person, so for me, like, I needed to lean on God. Like, I had a lot going on, and so for me, leaning onto a higher power when I couldn't speak to someone else was really helpful.
Yeah, so for me, it was primarily it was my wife. She, like I said earlier, we've been married 33 years. She's been with me my entire Army career, the deployments and the time away, and she's also a licensed clinical social worker and did some behavioral health work when we were stationed at Fort Benning years ago. And so she recognizes, how I was carrying myself. I've been accused of being stoic and reserved, guilty on both. But she recognized something wasn't right with me. So she just asked, you doing okay? And like I said, I said no. And then I went to the VA. And also some of the programs here at the museum I found incredibly helpful. And I mentioned it to Stacia earlier. We were doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu at the classes downstairs in the museum. And having that opportunity to focus on the present so you don't get choked out or arm-barred by your training partner really helps clear your head, because you're not thinking about Afghanistan or deployments or guilt or anything like that. You're focused on doing the activity that you're doing. And there's so many other things that are equally as beneficial. You know, equine therapy, fly fishing, beehivery, beekeeping, so many wonderful organizations and programs that are out there that help clear you and get you grounded.
Doug, let's jump into our first question.
Stacia, thank you so much. Thank you to today's panelists for a very frank conversation. Yes, I guess if your mind wanders during jiu-jitsu, that could be hazardous. So thank you. If you have a question for today's panelists, please do join us here at the microphone. We'll try to get to as many of your questions as we can. If you're watching online on YouTube, type your question in the chat. We'll try to get to as many of those. Great questions at CMC always have two things in common. They can be asked in just a sentence or two. And what punctuation mark does a question end with? It ends with a question mark. Yes, Sophia knows that one. I'm going to launch us off with this one, and then I'll turn it over to the audience behind me. If loneliness is becoming a public health challenge, should we begin treating social connection as civic infrastructure in the same way we think about parks, libraries, and transportation?
Okay. Yes. Yes. You know, as someone who, I teach a class on nonprofit organizing and social justice, which sounds really, really cool, but really it's just nonprofits 101, like philanthropy and community 101. And as someone who reads nothing but books about civics and connection and helping one another, I think our civic infrastructure is so important. If we want to solve issues connected to loneliness or polarization, we have to get to know one another. We need investment in third spaces. So investment in parks, in your local barbershop, at places like the Columbus Metropolitan Club, where you get to connect with other people. I think it's a tremendous solution to the loneliness epidemic. And if we want a brighter future where we can get along and talk to our neighbors and love our neighbors, then that definitely starts with investing in civic infrastructure.
Thank you. David Feldman, S4 Consulting. Over the decades, I've worked with a lot of really impressive service members like Colonel Butler. And in my experience, the U.S. military is generally far ahead of other organizations in terms of institutionally normalizing the practice of asking for help. So I'm curious, at an institutional level, what is a best practice, as an institutional best practice, that you used in a previous place of work that you've attempted to import into a new place of work? And how did that go about asking for help? Thank you.
So, I think normalizing it and reducing the stigma, for me in the battalion, the story that I shared, it was really easy to do because I had a guy who was tremendously respected in the organization. Everybody looked up to him. It's much harder to do in a community like this because, we're kind of bifurcated and stovepiped. People have got their own lives, and until you've got, a community leader like Sophia who's shared her story and her struggles, I think that will help start the conversation, which is one of the most important things, is taking that first step and having the courage to share and then following up with the conversations and demonstrating and leading by example.
Yeah, I'll also add, both in healthcare, in construction, in lots of other formats, there's a real need for leaders to not only give permission, but to proactively not only share stories, but create an infrastructure to seek help, like to make sure that folks are definitely not penalized formally or informally, and make it clear the expectations of what you have available, what will happen if you access this support, and to make sure people see seeking support as a sign of strength, that it's rewarded, not as like a, oh, okay, if you need it, or we could do this, or are you sure you're okay? Can you do that? Like in, if you look at in residency and internship for physicians, there's a great reduction in the use of support because they view there might be a penalty, there might be a cost, and you see a giant reduction, except if you're in a program where they make it explicit that help seeking is positive, it's encouraged, and you're viewed as a clinician who's using all the resources available to you. So it goes beyond just saying it's okay, or we have this service in the back of our brochure. It is empowering and modeling and using this, and then it becomes part of the norm. And then you see people using it. And until you do that, until you as a leader say this is not only okay, but encouraged, you're gonna have few people using it, and still that like low grade stigma will exist.
Katie Lundy with Inspire. Thank you so much for sharing all of your stories. It's very impactful. As somebody who helps run an organization that's largely women, we have one guy, I resonated with you with what you said, Sophia, about women feeling like we have to have it all the time. We have to have our stuff together all the time and balance all the things. We are in an isolation pandemic, right? We never really fully got over COVID, it feels like. I would love for you to speak to how things have changed since the pandemic itself in terms of isolation, and if we are pulling out of that, or are we still kind of in this stagnant area? And then how we can support the women of our team and our entire team, frankly, with wellness, because, you know, obviously making it accessible. But I feel like we need more than just a happy hour and taking your dog to work day. Like, I mean, we're trying, but we just really could use some examples for how we can open up the conversation, because we're hybrid too. We're only together twice a week. And so things can go by without being seen.
Sure. Thank you for your question. There are a couple of questions in there. One is, have things shifted since the pandemic? And I'd like to say that because of the pandemic, we're certainly more isolated. We leverage technology more often. From a work standpoint, there are a lot of individuals, myself included, who work in a hybrid setting or remotely or sometimes with people. And that definitely has had an impact on our society. But from a grander perspective, like over the last 125 years, Americans have less friends, they're not connecting with others. And this was happening even before the pandemic. So my recommendation, specifically for women, is one, I think that we all have to be more intentional in our relationships. I mean, how many of us who are in this audience, which I know are full of high achieving individuals who care about community, have, you know, 250 contacts on LinkedIn, but how many of them are people that you can actually call at 2 a.m. in the morning when something's going on? I think all of us can take intentional steps towards building deeper relationships with individuals. So not getting nervous when you met somebody, you're like, oh, this person's really awesome, I really like them, but then you haven't contacted them in 6 months, reach out to them anyways and just say, hey, I've been thinking about you, you're on my mind. You know, we should grab coffee sometimes. For the individuals in your office, more than just, hey, how are you? Maybe it's really like, how are you doing? I'm here for it. Like, what can I do to support you? Or maybe not even what can I do to support you, just, hey, I'm here if you ever need anything at all. And developing deeper friendships and relationships with those who you're interacting with at a workplace setting. And then last, because I am really passionate about civics and philanthropy, investing in your community. And that can show up in multiple ways, whether it's giving your time, talent, treasure, or testimony, or showing up to conversations like this, I think can really help more women create spaces of community.
Thank you. Erica Clark Jones says, today's participants are courageous examples for all of us. What national, local, national, or corporate resources do you find most helpful during difficult times?
Nationally, the VA is really impactful. And then there's a bunch of great organizations, depending on your interests and focus areas, that are out there here locally. And, you know, named a few, and it really depends on what, you know, if you're interested in, you know, physical activity or outdoor activity or, you know, spirituality, but having those connections is really important in being present and getting away from the dopamine injector that we all have in our pocket. And, you know, I've made it a point. I used to love to read, and, you know, I got away from it. So I made a point. I plug it in the bathroom at night an hour before I go to bed. So it forces me to read and not get, you know, into doom scrolling and reading the news and stupid videos on Instagram. So I think that's important, is to also take that into our relationships and to be present and not have the phone on the table when we're at dinner with our spouse or companion or friends, and, you know, not being distracted when our kids call by getting on the phone and, you know, getting on Instagram or not being present. So I think being present and reaching out to organizations where you might have an interest.
I can be very, very quick in terms of some of the national organizations. 988 is something we haven't mentioned. That's a sort of an opportunity for the suicide suicide crisis line that you can call if you're ever struggling about yourself or someone else to get 24/7 support. Kids Mental Health Foundation is another group that does a lot of good work in supporting parents, give information for the young people, and American Foundation for Suicide Prevention and Ohio Suicide Prevention Foundation are some great local resources as well.
I wish we had at least another hour to continue this conversation. I feel like we barely scratched the surface, but we do have to wrap up. So we want to turn things back over now to Niel Jurist for closing remarks. Niel.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Columbus Metropolitan Club's weekly forum on 90.5 WCBE. This week's conversation on mental well-being focused on connection, resilience, and the courage to be present when it matters most. We welcome Sophia Fiffner with the Columbus Metropolitan Club, Dr. John Ackerman with Nationwide Children's Hospital, and Bill Butler with the National Veterans Memorial and Museum. Your host was Stacia Nakin, news anchor with WBNS 10 TV. This week's forum was sponsored by the Thanks Be to God Foundation. The presenting sponsor of our live stream was the Center for Human Kindness at the Columbus Foundation, with the Columbus Dispatch as our live stream partner. Additional support was provided by Downtown Columbus Incorporated and the National Veterans Memorial and Museum. If you'd like to keep exploring this week's forum topic, our fantastic partners at the Columbus Metropolitan Library recommend reading A Little More Social: How Small Choices Create Unexpected Happiness, Health, and Connection by Nicholas Epley. Join us next week as the not-for-profit Columbus Metropolitan Club once again connects people and ideas through community conversations. I'm Doug Buchanan. Thanks for listening.